From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. An extraordinary last day of the General Assembly session is getting underway just hours after its longest-serving speaker, Michael Bush, succumbed yesterday to pneumonia and other health problems. As tributes to Bush pour in, the delegates and senators have work to do before midnight. When the speaker's illness kept him from the House last week, Senate President Mike Miller reflected on presiding over a legislature that has met for four centuries.
It just shows that the place is more important than any one individual. It's more important than me, it's more important than the speaker, and the place has been in existence since the founding of the colony. It'll be continue to be in existence.
WIPR's former news analyst Fraser Smith remembers Speaker Bush. And State House reporters Rachel Bay and Danielle Gaines bring us up to date on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. When he died yesterday of pneumonia and other complications, Michael Bush had presided over the Maryland House of Delegates longer than any speaker in the chamber's 400-year history. Today, the legislative session will come to a close without him, the first sine die without Bush since 2003. As midnight approaches, lawmakers will hammer out details of their bills, or not. We'll hear about that later in the show. But first, former WIPR senior political analyst Fraser Smith joins me to reflect on Speaker Bush's career and legacy. Welcome to the show, Fraser.
It's good to be here.
What will you remember about Speaker Bush?
You know, it'll be personal, and I think that would probably true of just about everybody in the assembly and the reporting corps that was down there that really appreciated how open and available he always was. For me, it was just kind of, I think it's an element of charisma that he had. You liked being around him. Again, for me, it had a lot to do with sports.
Sports.
Because he
was a coach.
He was a coach and he was a great player. And if it hadn't been for a bad knee injury, he probably would have been a professional player. But, there were these kinds of things to talk about. And he used to joke with me a little bit because I did a book about Len Bias, the basketball player, and it had a personal foreword in the book. And I talked a little bit about playing football. And so he would come up and needle me a little bit about it. And we would talk. And we actually had about an hour or so once at one of the nominating conventions, one of the national conventions. And for some reason, he wasn't the speaker, so he had some spare time. And he and I talked for about an hour, I think, in a coffee shop in Atlanta. But I also spent time with him in his office talking to him about issues, of course. And he was just such an open guy. And, you know, he cared so much about what he was doing. I mean, when I heard that he wasn't going to be there on sine die, I knew that things were really not going well.
Bush was a Democrat elected in 1986 to represent part of Anne Arundel County, elected speaker 16 years later. Why did his colleagues choose him? What went into that?
Well, for one thing, I think he was very alert, and I think people who are in the political ballgame are always thinking about what's next. If they're not thinking about how do I hang on to what I've got, they're thinking about what's next. And so you're looking around and you're sort of game planning things. And I think right away he realized after Casper Taylor was unexpectedly defeated in Western Maryland.
Casper Taylor was the speaker.
He was the speaker, yes. And I think Mike Bush understood that there was an opening there. Obviously, everybody did, and he knew enough people probably to have an instant organization. And I think a lot of people probably felt about him the way I've just expressed, and I think he probably was able to pull together the votes quite quickly.
And what did his becoming speaker mean for the House? I mean, In what ways was he different from his predecessors?
I don't know if he was radically different. I think he was, as people are saying today, a pragmatic guy. He understood that what was done was done. For example, on slots, he was very much against them. But once they got here, I mean, the interim step, of course, was being...
Slot machine gambling.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think he realized that a good thing to do was to turn it over to the voters. And was overwhelmingly supported. So that was the deal. And so we had to go forward from there. It wasn't something he spent a lot of time on worrying about.
That's longtime political commentator Fraser Smith with us on the record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the death of House Speaker Michael Bush just hours before the last day of this legislative session. So what would you describe, what would you expect to be Mike Bush's biggest impact on Maryland?
Well, he did a fantastic job. He was so proud of the job and of the assembly, and I was amused to read today that he couldn't go to the Naval Academy because his grades were not up to the standard. The one thing I was always impressed about with him was when, at the beginning of legislative sessions, there would be conversations with Mike Miller, the Senate president, about the issues. And Mike Bush knew the issues A to Z always. Miller was really good on the big picture, and Bush knew the details of everything. I was just always so impressed about that. And I think it was an orderly House. I mean, there are a lot of independent thinkers there. People say it's quite liberal. I don't know if that's true still. But He ran the operation extremely well. I think he knew how to convince people, Republicans and Democrats, of what he thought was the best solution of any problem for the state of Maryland. And one of the things that I think about today is, here's the guy that grew up in the shadow of the state house. It was like it wasn't your high school that you identified with, but...
Yeah, he was born in Baltimore, but grew up in Annapolis.
Exactly. But I think he and Miller both are very solicitous of the honor and integrity and process of the General Assembly of Maryland. For them, it was personal. And I think he conveyed that to the people that were in both of those chambers.
Was Speaker Bush a big factor in Maryland approving same-sex marriage?
I'm sure he was. I'm sure he was. I wasn't there when that was done, but I'm sure he was. We're getting, and we'll get more testimony from people who will talk about what an important factor he was in issues that were not partisan. They could be broken down that way, of course, but I think what they were doing was trying to understand where the people were. It is a people's legislature, and you know, when the high school coach becomes the speaker of the House of Delegates, you see it. You know, you see exactly what it is that we're made up of, and it's a good thing.
So you're going to remember all these things you've described. Is there a particular incident on the floor that's going to stick with you?
No, I think the incident that sticks with me is hearing how incredibly conversant he was in all of the issues that he was going to be dealing with. And personally, again, it'll go back to football. I have to admit it.
Fraser, I appreciate your coming in to reflect on him. Thank you.
Good to be with you, Sheila.
Fraser Smith, after a career at the Baltimore Sun, was WIPR's news analyst for 10 years, and now he's writing a memoir of the newspaper business. Quick break here on the record. When we come back, what legislation is still in play as the clock ticks toward the end of this session? We'll hear from two State House reporters on the ground in Annapolis. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Senators, delegates, staff, lobbyists, scores of others are making last-minute tweaks to bills as the 439th session of the General Assembly draws to a close. With us to walk through some of these issues are two reporters completely up to speed on the thinking in Annapolis. Danielle Gaines covers the legislature for the news site Maryland Matters. Welcome back to the show, Danielle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And WYPR State House reporter Rachel Bay. Thanks for joining us, Rachel.
Of course, my pleasure.
So let's start, Rachel, with the Clean Energy Jobs Act. This bill would require more of Maryland's energy, more of its electricity, to be generated from renewable sources. And that, what does that have to do with jobs?
Yeah, so the idea here, and this is something that in previous years has also been billed as a job piece of legislation, a jobs-creating legislation. So the idea is that by encouraging investment in renewable energy sources, you are increasing the number of jobs in those industries. So people who are working in the solar and wind industries, for example.
And this is a bill that looks like it's on its way to passage?
Yeah. So it, for a while there, it looked like it was a little bit on shaky ground, but it's up for a final vote in the House today. And there are some House amendments that would need to be approved by the Senate, but they don't look like they are things that would cause much of a fight. So assuming they don't run out of time, it looks like it's on its way to passing.
Republicans have raised concerns about the impact on people's bills.
Yes, and that's something, again, so this is this bill would increase the use of renewable energy to 50% of the state's electricity supply by the year 2030. And a few years ago, you may recall, they did a similar thing, 25% by the year 2025. And each time that they increased this renewable energy component of the electricity source, the Republicans raised these concerns about electric bills. And kind of the counterpoint is always, well, it's only going to be a couple of dollars. And in the long term, it could actually end up leveling out. So it's, yes. That is a concern. It's not entirely clear exactly how much it would affect people's bills. It is likely that they would see a small increase.
Danielle, a bill was filed relatively late to establish a mediation body to handle thousands of cases alleging injury from asbestos. Why are proponents seeking to move those cases out of the courts?
Yes. So this is a bill that was filed, as you said, in the last week of March, and it zoomed through the Senate. It got through the Senate in the space of a week and was heard by the House of Delegates on Friday. This is a bill that is supported by plaintiff's attorneys who want to see these 32,000 or so asbestos cases pending in the Baltimore City Circuit Court shifted to an office of mediation. They say mediation will get people to the table faster and will allow claims to be adjudicated more quickly. Some of these cases have been filed since the 80s or 90s. They also say that the process that's set up by the Baltimore City Court is too cumbersome for them. So there's a status conference that's held in every case, and the plaintiff's attorneys have to present various facts about whether or not the case is viable to move forward, so what injuries their plaintiffs have and that sort of information. They say that requires them to produce, you know, tens of thousands of documents when these cases are heard hundreds at a time. Defense attorneys say that, you know, these types of claims can be filed on a short form, and they contain really very little information. So what's happening at the static conferences is they're getting the most basic information they need to decide whether or not to settle the case or challenge it or move forward. And, you know, sending it to mediation would cut off the process too quickly. They also note that a number of cases have been dismissed or settled at the status conferences. So the creation of a mediation office would slow things down at this point.
Rachel, let's talk about the Curwen Commission. Lawmakers have been wrestling with its recommendations. It's named for William Britt Curwen, former State University Chancellor who chaired the commission. Recommendations include raising teacher pay, expanding early childhood education, and aiming for every student to be ready for college or a career by 10th grade. What progress have legislators made?
So that bill is done. That bill has passed completely. And it is worth noting that in the process of getting this bill to passage, it underwent a bunch of changes. And really, kind of the bottom line here is that it starts the ball rolling on a lot of the things that you've mentioned, but it doesn't really complete that process. So, in other words, we're going to see more legislation next year and perhaps for years to come that kind of gradually implement a lot of the recommendations of the Curwen Commission. And chief among them is really the funding. So the big question that still remains for the legislature is how they're going to pay for a lot of these changes. Now, they've funded everything that's in this first bill. There's some funding in for the next, for fiscal years 2021 and 2022 in this bill that is matching within the budget currently. But for the remaining years going forward, the Curwen Commission has a 10-year phase-in plan, and for those remaining years, we're still kind of figuring out how the state's going to pay for those changes.
And I gather they're looking at a lot of different sources, like legalizing recreational marijuana and taxing it, or sports betting, or gathering sales tax from new sources. Tell us about that sales tax idea.
Yeah, so and people have called this kind of the Wayfair bill. There was a bill that passed this year that basically helps the state collect sales tax on online sales, Wayfair being the online company that sells kind of a competitor to sites like Amazon. So this bill, there is a clause in the bill that passed, the Curwen Commission bill that passed, that says that if this new sales tax on online sales generates an excess of $100 million in revenue, that amount above $100 million will go toward paying for some of these proposals.
That's Rachel Bay, WIPR Statehouse reporter, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Danielle Gaines of Maryland Matters. We're talking about the legislative session that ends at midnight. Danielle, we're just over a month away from running of the Preakness Stakes at Pimlico Racecourse in Baltimore. The race will be run at Pimlico in 2020 also, but after that, its future is unclear. The track owner wants to move the Preakness to its other property, Laurel Park Racetrack. It's requested bonds to make improvements at that track. Is it looking today like lawmakers will grant that request?
It's very unclear at this point. So the Preakness, of course, is a grand tradition in the city of Baltimore, and you've got a Baltimore delegation that is looking to do as much as they can to keep that race in the city, which it is mandated by state law to run there at this point. But to keep that race in the city, to keep Pimlico grounds as nice and well-kept as possible. But the owners of the property are their private property owners, and they want to invest their money in the racetrack down at Laurel. So the Senate passed a bill on Friday. It was very hastily, or sometime late last week. It's hard to tell at this point. But it was kind of hastily arranged, and it basically sets up a process where the Strategy Group would be able to invest in Laurel, but they also would have to invest in Pimlico at the same time. And if they didn't meet requirements for reinvesting in Pimlico, they would be able to be fined by the city of Baltimore. This bill, you know, was debated pretty heavily in the Senate, and the main argument was that this puts some level of trust in the Strawnish Group. It allows them to tap these revenues that are available to all horse racing tracks to, you know, apply to all of their properties as they see fit. And the Strawnish Group replied that they, you know, feel like this bill would open the conversation for how to move forward in future years. On Saturday, though, as reported by the Baltimore Sun, the Baltimore City delegation
House delegation voted 16-0 in opposition of this bill. So it's really unclear whether or not that would make it through the House today.
Yeah, that's got to be a bad sign for any legislation when the local delegation unanimously says don't
do it. And earlier this session, the Baltimore County delegation had expressed solidarity with the city. I don't know where they are on the record, but that is a promise that was made at one point this year.
Rachel, on health care, there's an issue that deals with ensuring that low-income Marylanders have health insurance. Tell me about the Maryland Easy Enrollment Health Program.
Right. So this is a bill. First of all, this is passed. It's done. And this is a bill that came into the legislature as a proposed state-level individual mandate, mandating people to have insurance or else pay a fine. That fine has been stripped out of the legislation. So what this bill does now is when you file your taxes, if you don't have health insurance, because as you recall, you have to check a box on your tax return saying whether you have health insurance. If you don't have it, the comptroller's office can then respond to you with more information saying if you qualify for this no-cost or low-cost insurance, you qualify for Medicaid, you qualify for these federal subsidies and that would pay for the bulk of your premium at the in the health benefit exchange. Would you like more information about how to enroll? And then the that information, if you say yes, your information gets sent to the exchange who then will help you get set up with that enrollment.
So that's done. I mean, that decision is done?
That's done. And it's estimated that this would, even if you just look at the people who are eligible for Medicaid, it's estimated that, and I think it's about 70,000 Marylanders are probably eligible for Medicaid, but not currently enrolled, which means that they could get health insurance for no cost to them. And this bill is designed to try to capture some of that group of people.
Another bill related to health we talked about on the record last week is would be to set up a board to look at the affordability of some very expensive name brand drugs. The version that the Senate passed or is considering is significantly weaker than the version that the House passed last month. Briefly summarize that for us.
Yeah, so this bill creates a board called the Prescription Drug Affordability Board that under the version the House passed would be able to go to prescription drug companies, drug manufacturers, and say, we know that you're charging this much for your drug, but Marylanders are only going to pay this much. And you can choose to sell it to them or not, but this is the cap on how much they will pay. And the Senate removed that part of the legislation. So right now that bill is probably headed to a conference committee. The House has already appointed a conference committee, so that means that they're not willing to accept those changes from the Senate. It's not clear whether the House and the Senate are going to be able to come to an agreement, given how far apart they are on this particular bill.
We're almost out of time. Let me ask you, Danielle, about the University of Maryland Medical System in the headlines about after news that 9 members of the board, including Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh, had business deals with this system. What attempts, Danielle, have lawmakers made to ward off political conflicts of interest, conflicts of interest, excuse me?
Yes. So there is a bill that is moving forward. There's slight differences between 2 bills in the House and the Senate. The House version of this bill was, of course, sponsored by the late Speaker Bush, who was a member of the board for many years. And the Senate bill is sponsored by Senator Jill Carter. There are slight differences between the bills that will have to be worked out or agreed to, but both measures replace the board with new members over a period of several months, and people can reapply. And they also require financial disclosures, prohibitions on no bid contracts, a ban on board members having financial relationships and other safeguards. And that's definitely going to move forward.
And there is a lot more going on today, but we are out of time. We are sine die, so we have to leave it there. Thank you both.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Rachel Bay covers the State House for WYPR. Danielle Gaines is a politics reporter for the news site Maryland Matters. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we have links to their recent reporting about the legislature. On the Record's director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. Maureen Harvey and Melissa Gear produced the program. John Ahrens wrote and recorded the On the Record theme music. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're listening. Join us again.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.